Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Barbara Bogave. Books, what are they worth? At Yale University, there's a huge marble paneled cube on stilts in a courtyard. It's the Beinecke Library, which houses one of the world's great collections of rare books. This is an amazing building. The sunlight filters in through the marble like the light in your dreams. Now, the cube has a glass-enclosed core where the rare books live. And now I'm getting to the freaky part. The library is equipped with a fire suppression system that, in the event of a blaze, floods the glassed-in book stacks with halon gas. Halon gas can quickly extinguish flames, no water necessary, so no damage to the books. Unfortunately, the gas would also suffocate anyone unlucky enough to be in the stacks at the time. The engineers and everyone involved in the Beinecke project considered this an acceptable risk when things like the Gutenberg Bible are at stake. It makes you think. For thousands of years, libraries have been revered as priceless repositories for the world's knowledge and culture. Invaluable. But is that still true? Today, anyone can do research, read the world's greatest books, find periodicals, and access government documents with nothing more than a computer and a modem. So, is it time to put the fire extinguishers back into Beinecke? Who needs libraries anyway? We sent producer Richard Paul to investigate.
As we're approaching the vault, we see something that looks like a bank vault door. In fact, that's exactly what it is.
We're underground, about a block from the U.S. Capitol building, standing in front of a huge 10-inch thick metal door. It's got a set of bars beyond it.
This door is not ever opened outside of business hours.
We're about to enter the rare book vaults at the Folger Shakespeare Library. To get here, we've already walked past the old reading room, passing beneath the stained glass window depicting the Seven Ages of Man speech from As You Like It, with its stone tracery that's a replica of the Holy Trinity Church in Stratford-on-Avon, walking past 16th-century Flemish tapestries and a Jacobean acorn leg table from 1620, and the crypt where they keep the ashes of Mr. and Mrs. Folger. We're standing with librarian Richard Kukta amidst the display cases in the wood-paneled treasure room.
And there is a kind of moment here before you approach the vault door at which you pause and you reflect, and it's kind of a gee whiz. Gee, if this is out here, what's behind the door?
Kukta inserts a key, and the vault swings open. We turn a corner, pass a second door. And find ourselves facing about 80 of the most valued and valuable objects of Western culture.
One of the things that you can see is this wall of wonderful bindings in front of you is the Folger's collection of first folios.
There were four editions of Shakespeare's plays printed in the 17th century. The first folio came out in 1623. 240 copies exist in the world. The last time one sold, it went for $6.2 million. The Folger has 79 of them.
Let's go look at some other books.
We walk past a guard desk and into a conference room where items are laid out on a large table. Kukta picks up a child's school book from the 16th century.
And on the recto at the bottom is a very bold signature. It says, "This book is mine, Prince Henry." What we have in front of us here is a schoolboy copy of Cicero that belonged to the future Henry VIII. It's a remarkable signature, and it's a voice that comes out to us very definitively. This book is owned by a person who later owned women and religion and everything else that he could get his hands on.
The Folger is not a museum. It's a working library. Historians, bibliographers, and scholars come here from all over the world to do what people do in any library: pick up books, hold them in their hands, and read them. According to the book A History of Instructional Technology, Thomas Edison predicted in 1913 that books would be obsolete in the schools, killed off by motion pictures. The Folger's Richard Kukta says that prediction is no more likely in the computer age than it was back then.
The book is a physical object, is a technology that hasn't been eclipsed in 500 years. There are things you still discover when an object is in front of you. There's also a great pleasure, I think, in holding a book. The comfort, the ease, that it's a sensation that really isn't duplicated sitting in front of a monitor.
But in a digital age when books, along with songs, movies, and photographs, can be scanned and then circulated all over the world in seconds, isn't there another kind of comfort and ease? If you could get Shakespeare's first folios online in your home without having to travel to a big building filled with books in Washington, D.C., isn't that comfort and ease enough? These days, a lot of people say, yes, it is. And some say that what we think of as the library is about to suffer dramatically as a result. Rick Anderson is Director of Resource Acquisition at the University of Nevada, Reno Libraries. He says that for many people, these days, the attitude towards libraries is,
why should I go there when the content is available to me in an online format? For students in higher education, they're not about to go pawing through the book stacks or flipping through the pages of a 10-volume reference work in order to find the answer, because experience has taught them that the answer is probably out there online.
When I was a kid, I spent almost all my paper route money buying 8mm movies, mostly Charlie Chaplin from the Black Hawk Films catalog in Iowa. They rented and sold 8mm, Super 8, and 16mm movies to schools, social clubs, and individuals like me, part of a multi-billion dollar home entertainment business that made and sold projectors and duplicated films on every subject. They even had movies to tell you how to run your movie projector.
Each film roller guide should be rotated and all dirt, lint, and film emulsion removed with an aperture brush.
The 1980s brought the video revolution. Blackhawk invested heavily in Betamax and the RCA video disc, and by 1987, the handwriting was on the wall and they shut down forever. It's not every industry that's visited by the grim reaper of obsolescence, but these days it's happening more and more. The pace of technology is blistering, and if you can't adapt, it doesn't matter how long you've been around, how central you've been to life as we know it, like the corner travel agent, AT&T long distance, or whiteout, you may find yourself virtually worthless.
This is our Ecole system, you know, school in French, and it's very user-friendly.
And today, there are those who warn that as technology changes the information world, school libraries, university libraries, and public libraries are the next to go. The University of Nevada's Rick Anderson.
We do run the risk of becoming irrelevant.
They can do a quick search or a power search. Also, they can just search at Herndon High School, our library, or they can search anywhere in the county.
Think about how your information needs have changed. If you're old enough, you can remember what it was like to find a fact in the days before Google.
There are the reference librarians who help readers in their search for special information.
I'm starting on a new project on radar. Could you compile a bibliography on this subject for me?
The reference librarians locate various materials through their familiarity with the contents of the library, a very important money and time-saving service to the public.
Today, pretty much anything that you used to need a reference librarian for is available online. Same with that other mainstay of the library, periodicals and academic journals, which Rick Anderson points out are all online now, too.
It wasn't very long ago that patrons and librarians thought of the library as a print collection with a complementary online collection. You know, the library is these 900,000 books, and then there are also these good online resources. I think that many librarians, still think of their collections that way. I think patrons think of library collections in exactly the opposite way.
That view is confirmed by the president of the American Library Association, Carol Bray Cassiano, who is also the head librarian at the public library in El Paso, Texas.
In my library situation, we have just barely begun to talk about digitization, and there are many other libraries that do not have this on their radar screen at all.
So let's say you're a reporter trying to check a fact. Say someone told you something that you need to confirm, like,
we are actually seeing the usage of libraries increase phenomenally.
I went to the internet and checked that fact. I found my answer in less than 5 minutes. I'll tell you what I found later on. But that was certainly less time than it would take to get in the car and drive to the nearest library. So considering this, and considering the National Endowment for the Arts Reading at Risk study that says electronic media are becoming the dominant influence in young people's worlds, and that the numbers of American adults reading anything between two covers has declined 7% in the past decade, it makes you wonder, who's picking up books anymore?
I enjoy reading for several reasons.
Reading takes you everywhere.
It's fantasizing, you know, living in another life.
Well, I just really took up reading again because I've been taking the subway.
Reading is the most fun you can have alone.
There. Interviews to warm the heart of any librarian. Except those interviews weren't done at a library. They were done at a Barnes & Noble that's 3 blocks away from a library. While these interviews were being done, the library sounded like this. Because the library was closed. From what we've heard so far, the situation for libraries looks pretty bleak. So how come they keep building them?
Already, Seattleites are eyeing the new building like a Christmas present they can't wait to unwrap. George Sudakawa's fountain burbles and buses roar past. As
Seattle's stunning new Central Library isn't the only one that's open lately.
Everybody can move up because there's plenty of seats, and that way people don't.
This is a meeting in the northwestern corner of Washington, D.C.
And tonight, we have Grimm & Parker Architects, who is going to lead a discussion for programming and designing of the Tenley Friendship Library.
Last year, 103 new public libraries opened. 92 more were thoroughly renovated, and the year before was about the same. Even with tight budgets and states cutting back, libraries are still being built.
I really appreciate everybody coming out tonight. I think the more input we can get from the community, the better.
How can it be with computers taking over more and more of what libraries used to be used for? How can it be that libraries are still seen as so necessary? Let's take a look.
These are automatic doors are going to just swing in here. This is a climate-controlled facility.
We're in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, in what you might call the dead book room at the Washington Research Library Consortium Central Warehouse. The consortium is made up of 8 university libraries in Washington, D.C., and this is where they send books they don't feel like keeping on campus anymore. This room now contains more volumes than several of the member libraries. The consortium's executive director, Lizanne Payne, reads through some of the titles.
Fish immunology, diseases of fishes. Endogenous and exogenous opiate agonists and antagonists, 1979. Eclectic.
Yes. Payne says this room helps demonstrate how the university library is changing in order to survive.
It's certainly less important as a storage space for books. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that we have the off-site book storage warehouse here, because we want to help the libraries to reconfigure their campus library space for uses other than for books.
Today, she says the library is more of a gathering place, a place to study, a campus hub. Also, according to Rick Anderson of the University of Nevada Libraries,
the numbers of people who come through our doors on a daily basis are very, very high, but a significant majority of those users are coming in to use our computers.
Don't students have computers in their dorm rooms? Yes, but Anderson points out that at the university library, you can find a deeper level of online material, stuff you'd never find on Google.
What many of them are doing is just going straight to the lists of e-journals that we have, or straight to the lists of online databases. The usage of our online journals is absolutely astronomical.
Anderson's library has access to 14,000 online academic journals. He says that's what people are coming to the university library for. And he says if university libraries want to maintain a place of prominence on campus, they're going to have to recognize that.
We will serve our patrons much better, and we will be much more effective ourselves as a profession if we look at the directions that patron behavior is going and move our services into the path of the patrons by getting as much of the content that we purchase for our patrons in online formats as possible.
Right now I'm taking one of the sheets from, it's the date of May 22nd, 1945.
In a room across the hall from the dead book warehouse, technician Mimi Shade slips a piece of yellowed newsprint into a digital scanner.
And I place the sheet face down on the scanner, close the lid on the top, and then go into the scanning program.
She's working to digitize the original typewritten columns of the pioneering investigative journalist Drew Pearson, which were given to the American University Library after Pearson died in 1969.
And I click OK, and then I'll hit scan, and it'll scan the document, and it'll show up on my screen.
As of now, the consortium focuses on digitizing manuscripts, photograph collections, and some archival material. They've scanned Civil War letters and set designs from the Federal Theater Project. But as for Rick Anderson's suggestion of getting as much of the content to patrons in online formats as possible, well, That's going to take a while. The consortium's Lizanne Payne says Mimi is the only technician doing this kind of work. Typically, she scans only 50 to 100 sheets a day.
Oh, there's a huge sense of urgency. There's just not a huge amount of money. It's expensive for the library to divert their staff to arrange and organize the material to send to us. It's expensive for us to have staff here to do it. It takes a lot of work, even on the library side, to get this material ready to be scanned.
Right now, she says, what gets converted is whatever someone feels like converting or whatever someone can get funding to convert. And the Folger Shakespeare Library's Richard Kuchta says there's more working against digitization than just the issues of time, expense, and the fragility of old books.
When you work from an electronic surrogate of a book, you have images, high-resolution images of a single copy of a book. What you don't see are other copies of that same edition, or indeed other editions.
The Folger, for instance, has digitized only one of their 79 first folios. The project took 2 years to complete.
Certainly, it gets an important copy out into the public exposure, so to speak. But there are 78 copies that weren't filmed. And let me show you one of those copies that weren't filmed and what we're missing by not filming it.
He pulls one of the first folios off a shelf and turns to the title page, where there's a handwritten inscription.
It says, Elizabeth O'Kell, her book, 1729. And as we look in the preliminary pages, one of the things you see here is a child's doodles. Here you have a woman who looks sort of like a queen. And you turn the page a little bit more, and here you have houses and chimneys, and looks like a tea table.
Imagine a historian coming across a magical surprise like that inside a book. What something like that can tell you about daily life in the early 18th century. And you miss out on more than that when you can only digitize one copy. The first folio is more than 900 pages, and in those days, no single print shop could handle a job that big. So different portions of the book were printed by different people.
And so you have people spelling words using punctuation differently. I'll give you an example. Hamlet's first soliloquy comes onto the stage, and he says, "Oh, this tutu solid flesh." Another copy, "Oh, this tutu solid flesh." And copy three in the Folger collection, "Oh, this tutu soiled flesh." Well, which is it? In fact, it's printed three different ways in the folios, and Mr. and Mrs. Folger were sort of smart enough and to realize that the variants would made each copy different, and people are still studying and arguing about those variants 400 years later.
Nonetheless, there is a growing consensus among librarians that widespread digitization needs to happen if libraries are going to remain relevant.
In order to be a research library in this century, we need to provide text in various forms.
At the same time, librarians are wary. Even if they could move everything from print to online, would that be the smartest thing? Here's the Washington Consortium's Bruce Hulse.
Some of the more serious issues are, the material that it's stored on can still deteriorate. The systems used to read the data change over time. So there's got to be better processes put in place to guarantee that the integrity of the data will remain constant.
And there's another problem. Remember those 14,000 online academic journals they have access to at the University of Nevada libraries? Well, let's say 50 years from now, you wanted to go back and look at a journal article from 2004. You might be in for a nasty surprise.
Can I help you, please?
Yeah, I tried to order some books, and they sent me this notice, said I had to appear at the center personally.
That's right. This is our circulation unit. You can make your choice here or by catalog. There must be some mistake. The books you've ordered are classified and have been transcribed and summarized.
That's James Caan in the science fiction movie Rollerball. As part of the plot, all the books in the world have been digitized, but the computers that hold them have started to lose things.
A little confused again here today. This is embarrassing. It's embarrassing to misplace things.
Misplacing data?
The whole of the 13th century.
Science fiction, of course, but when it comes to academic journals, there's a chance it might actually happen. See, even though you go to the library to read an online journal, the library doesn't physically possess that document. The publisher does. And Lizanne Payne of the Washington Consortium says there's no system in place to guarantee that in 50 years, the information you want will still be there.
Libraries, under most current licensing arrangements, don't have the rights to maintain the material in perpetuity, and the publisher may have the rights but hasn't taken on the responsibility.
Many see the day coming soon when the computer revolution will swamp the library. Here's the University of Nevada's Rick Anderson.
Books are becoming increasingly vestigial. You know, they're becoming more and more like the little toe. If you were to sit down and look over the last 10 years at the themes of library conferences, you would find a sharp increase over the last decade in conferences that have themes like librarians are essential, you know, libraries are still vital to the community. And I think it's an index of the actual position that librarians are in that we find it necessary to reassure ourselves about this over and over again.
But the evidence so far is not there, and certainly not when you're talking about the nation's public libraries. Andrew Gordon is a professor of public affairs at the University of Washington. For the last 5 years, he's been doing an independent evaluation of the Gates Library Initiative, which is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's effort to provide access to computers through public libraries. He and his team have visited 400 to 500 libraries all over the country to try and figure out what computers are doing to librarians.
I thought the computers would only complicate their life, and it would mean that people were less likely to come to the library for any other purpose than perhaps computing. In fact, what we have found is libraries are busier than ever. Things are different. Things are vital. Libraries are important.
Over here you'll see we have a bank of 16 computers.
Gail Gormley gives a tour of the Bethesda, Maryland Public Library, one of the couple hundred public libraries that have been newly renovated lately.
And to the right of that, there are two individual rooms that we call the tutor rooms or small study rooms.
She says library use is up, and her observations are backed up by national numbers. Remember earlier when I told you I did a web search and found my information in 5 minutes? What I found was a study done by George D'Elia, who's at the Center for Applied Research in Library and Information Science at SUNY Buffalo. Since the late 1960s, on average, about 65% of adults, when asked if they visited a public library, will say yes. I found a study that D'Elia did in 2000.
The proportion of people who reported that they went to the public library was 66%.
D'Elia says people who compare the library and the computer to the car and the horse and buggy are looking at the wrong analogy. Instead, he says, look at what television did to radio.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Variety shows, dramas, all of which were programming in radio in the 30s and 40s, migrated to television, but radio did not wither on the vine. Radio just changed its format.
21 to 44, WCLN, a 10 to 20% chance of rain tonight, even though it looks pretty cloudy out. Tomorrow, cloudy again with a high in the 70s.
What's happened, he says, is that people are using the internet for information that they would not ordinarily go to a library for. Specific facts, like what year was the Emancipation Proclamation signed, or what time zone is Albuquerque in. D'Elia's numbers show that public libraries are doing fine.
I'd like to welcome you all tonight to our final program of the library's summer reading program.
And Andrew Gordon says that's because, like university libraries,
they reinvented themselves. They become community centers in addition to libraries.
So I'm going to start out with kind of a shortened version of Mozart's Eine kleine Nacht music.
In middle-class and wealthy neighborhoods, libraries are placed to hear a concert or attend a community event. And in poorer communities, in the inner city and in small rural towns, which is where half the libraries in America are located, Andrew Gordon says computers have literally brought libraries back to life.
People would write back these long comments and say, we were practically dying on the vine because we didn't have the budget to bring our books up to date. Computers have helped us become relevant resources for the community because they've expanded so dramatically the offerings that we can make.
I'm emailing and trying to finish some training from work.
And why here at the library?
Well, I don't have a computer at home.
And what about you? What are you working on?
Actually, I was just checking my email. Same thing. My computer's too slow at home.
And while computers are changing libraries, Dr. Martha Hale, dean of the School of Library Science at Catholic University, says they're also forcing librarians to change.
We're like everybody else, whether it's doctors or car mechanics. As their technology changes, they have to change what they do, and so do we.
She says librarians now field a lot more requests from people who've tried Google and are still stumped.
Librarians, instead of helping somebody to only use the things that are in the one-room library, are now helping them to be able to find things no matter where they are and no matter what format they are in.
But it's going to take a while to get there. We appear right now to be in the middle of the beginning of that transition. While some librarians are changing, others remain firmly rooted in the past. The University of Nevada's Rick Anderson wonders whether his colleagues are up to the challenge.
There's sort of a myth that I think the library profession has about itself, that it is a progressive, forward-thinking sort of profession. And we tell ourselves this, and we pat ourselves on the back about this a lot. In fact, I think that we tend to be kind of reactionary. The only way we're going to remain relevant and useful to the people that we are trying to serve is if we really take a hard look at fundamental aspects of the way we do our jobs.
Catholic University Library Dean Martha Hale is considerably less concerned.
I will argue very strongly that we will not go out of business as librarians. We may even change our name, but we're not going to go out of business, and neither is the library. There is going to be a place that people can come to where they can indeed access things and they can indeed connect things and they can have people help them.
In other words, to paraphrase that famous library book denizen Mark Twain, the rumors of the library's death may have been greatly exaggerated.
Surrounded by stories serene and sublime, I fell in love in the library.
Who Needs Libraries was produced by Richard Paul. We'd like to thank Garland Scott, head of public relations at the Folger Shakespeare Library, and Monica Lewis, director of communications for the District of Columbia Public Library. Marcy Silman of KUOW in Seattle provided us with her story about the new Seattle Library. Other archival footage comes from the Prelinger Archive, whose nearly 2,000 educational films are available on the web at archive.org. This program is part of our ongoing series on education and technology, funded in part by the U.S. Department of Education. For more information on libraries and on this story, you can visit our website online at soundprint.org. Support for Soundprint comes from Toadnet, a provider of business and residential DSL throughout the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Visit toad.net to learn more about Toadnet's internet services or call 877-GET-TOAD. On the next Soundprint, learning disabled students can get extra help in the classroom, but once they leave school, it's a different story. Join us for After Graduation, Meeting Special Needs, next week on Soundprint. CDs of Soundprint cost $12.50. You can order them at 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. If you'd like to keep in touch with us, we'd love to hear what you're thinking about our shows. Our email address is talkback@soundprint.org. That's one word, talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is technical director Anna Maria DeFreitas, associate producer Katie Gott, and sound engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Barbara Bogave.